You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Everybody, welcome to episode 4 of They Might Be Mariners, Lookout Landings, Prospects, Minor Leaguers, Drafts, you name it, they're not in the big leagues, we're talking about it. Podcast, my name is John Troopin. I am joined once again by Managing Editor of Lookout Landing, Kate Prusser.
Hello. Kate,
and Staff Writer Joe Doyle. Joe.
Howdy.
And we are breaking into the top 10 today for our top prospects list. I'm very excited to get into some of the more interesting names. Some of the names people I think are most familiar with, whether you're a prospect head or someone who's sort of casual in their following of the minor leagues and the draft and whatnot. But before we get into that, we're going to start with some semi-breaking news, I suppose. By the time this goes up, it will probably have a little more clarity, but today ESPN's Kylie McDaniel and Jeff Passan shared some information about the ongoing negotiations between the MLB Players Association and the league itself about how they're going to administer the MLB draft as part of their negotiations for, you know, how they're going to handle the shortened season and whatnot. Kate had an article go up a little bit after we're, or a little bit before we're recording this, rather. And Kate, could you just give us sort of the highlights or lowlights, I guess, of what the proposal is there and what sort of some of the main takeaways seem to be?
Yeah, so right now, we knew it would be a shortened draft. We knew it would be a later draft. So the date that they're looking at is July, which I think makes a lot of sense.
It might even make sense just generally going forward, right?
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
Post-college World Series, whatnot.
Yeah. I've always thought a slightly later draft, giving scouts a little more time to look at players. And obviously, that's a necessity this year, especially because clubs are currently barred from having any kind of contact with players, amateurs. So we've got that aspect and then some not as great aspects. We also, I mean, Manfred has been pushing for a shortened draft for a while. It kind of goes hand in hand with his plan to eliminate a bunch of minor league teams, which is obviously somewhat controversial. But this is a great chance for him to like kind of push across a few things that he wants, including that shortened draft. It is drastically shorter. So the MLB draft right now has 40 rounds. And I mean, I will say, I do think that the upper rounds of the draft get a lot of like legacy picks or courtesy picks, I like to call them, where it's like you pick the son of a scout who has been with the organization for a long time. It's like a lot of baseball just kind of patting itself on the back a little bit that really doesn't need to happen. High school kids being courtesy drafted. They were maybe projected to go in the higher round, but clubs thought they were an injury risk or like too strong of a college commitment, whatever. you know, so it's like, hey, we like you, but, you know, obviously no one drafted in like the 30th round is going to forego college if it's a highly touted player. Like Kumar Rocker getting picked in, what was it, like the 36th round last year, 2 years ago?
Yeah, a couple of years ago. Oh, yeah.
So I agree that the draft could be cut down, but this is 10 is what's being proposed, and it could go down to as few as 5 rounds, which obviously would cut a lot of players out of it. And then the bonus pools would also be restricted beyond those 5 or 10 rounds, whatever they decide to do, with a hard cap being suggested of $10,000 per player, which is like nothing.
For undrafted players.
That's like what a Penn Murphy gets out of in like the 26th round or whenever it was he was drafted. So, I know Joe has some thoughts on that, but this is pretty, it's very disincentivizing to players to enter the draft. If they're not drafted highly, it will encourage a lot of high schoolers to go on to college. It will encourage a lot of collegiates to return and kind of exhaust their eligibility. So bad plan in my opinion, but Joe is kind of our draft expert.
I don't know about that. No, I agree with you. I think the biggest thing with this is the signing bonus pools for these players at $10,000, at least that's what's being kicked around. That is such a disservice to the hundreds and hundreds of college players that have just been fringe guys, just trying to get their name out there for the last, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. And now it's their senior year, and they're going to have to settle for simply an opportunity to make it. I mean, I think I listed out some guys just from last year's draft for the Mariners. After the 5th round last year, even after the 10th round, Ty Adcock in the 8th round got $150,000. Carter Binns in the 11th round got $350,000. He was a junior sign, so it's a little bit different, but still, Carter's profile probably was never going to get him into the top 5 rounds even next year as a senior sign. And then you got guys like Reed Morgan, Patrick Frick, Travis Kuhn. All of them were between rounds 10 and 20, and they all made upwards of $100,000 to $125,000 in their signing bonus pools. And like that's all those guys really get, because once you're in the system, you make $20,000 a year. Yeah. So
maybe, I mean, if you're like a AAA guy.
That's what I mean. Like you top out at $20,000 a year, you're making like, what is it, like $13,000 up until AA now? Yeah. I mean, it's nothing. Yeah. So yeah, that's the disheartening part for me, is these guys have really grinded their teeth and you know, pushed their way up. I personally think they could limit any college signee after the draft to $125,000 or $100,000 and give them a cushiony to fall on. But I do like the idea of high school players being $10,000, just because I'm a big proponent of kids going to school anyways, just, you know, getting some of that experience. And if you're a premier high school talent, you're going to go in the top 5 rounds anyways, and you're going to be worth that money. So, yeah, I think that's the biggest travesty in it all.
I guess, just to me, like, some kids really just aren't interested in college. I'm thinking of Holden Laws, who we drafted a couple years ago. Just academics were not his strength. Like, he just didn't really like school, just wanted to play baseball, but like wasn't maybe one of those premier first round talents. So then it kind of forces a kid to go have a college education that like maybe he doesn't want really. And I don't know, it feels limiting to me. So not only is it limiting to the players who have worked really hard, and especially I think those fringe guys, it really places even more importance on that track that you get on starting really early, right? Like if you're not born in Texas, California, or Florida, like first of all, you're automatically going to have a tougher road now if the path is that much narrower. Like if you don't come from a family of privilege, if your family can't afford to put you on travel ball teams, if you're a late bloomer, like it's going to affect all these guys and the the ones who come through the traditional pipelines, like they do the showcase circuit, they're the big names. Those guys are going to be fine. But a guy who might have a little bit of a tougher road, a cold weather prospect, a guy who just, for whatever reason, scouts hasn't attracted a lot of buzz. Maybe he's not the hardest thrower, but he really knows how to pitch. Like, those guys are going to get overlooked. And I just think ultimately it's going to do a big disservice to the game.
I think not a lot to of mention, guys are going to be overlooked, yeah. I mean, you might even see teams shying away completely from senior players just because there's a limited number of picks. And, you know, a guy like Casey Opitz, the catcher for Arkansas, he's a great player. He's right on that fringe, fourth, fifth round. But if you know you're a team that only has five picks in the draft and you have this bonus pool that you can spend, and there's a high schooler there in the fifth round that you're obviously not going to go out and overslot him in the 12th round now, you got to take him in the fifth. And then, you know, yeah. Casey Opitz is all of a sudden being
making $10,000 when he should have made, you know, hundreds.
He's Carter. He's basically, I mean, they're a totally different profile, but Carter Benz is a great example. Like, if that guy wouldn't, he probably wouldn't have gotten picked in the first five rounds. He was picked in the 11th round. He got $350,000 and he's going to get 10 just because of that. I don't know. Anyways, yeah, it's a sticky situation, and I totally understand that it's an unprecedented year. It has to be a little bit different, as John pointed out, because there's just simply not enough room in the farm systems with people not moving up through the systems early in the year. But still, it just seems like such a disservice to, you know, so many people. I mean,
So many ramifications of this, too. Like, if these guys remain in college and if high school players go to college, the college rosters are going to swell. So then you're going to have a bunch of guys fighting for playing time. You're going to have scouting departments stretched a little more thin because maybe a guy who was going to be like at Kentucky suddenly finds himself squeezed out of playing time and he goes to a directional school somewhere. And then you can't send one scout to scout all the Kentucky players. You have to go chase this guy down at Kentucky too. So
yeah, it's trickle down. And you know, the most interesting thing that I heard about it, just on a final note, is this would probably end up having the 2023 draft being absolutely supercharged with talent, that would be kind of fun. And ideally the Mariners wouldn't be at the top of that draft, but it is something to keep an eye on. There's a lot of circumstances that'll kind of trickle down through all this.
It's definitely, I think, a really sort of challenging situation no matter what. Like, there has to be some sort of creative solution for it. And I think there's also a challenge of, like, I know Division II athletes are getting an extra year of eligibility for spring sports. I don't know yet that Division I has made a determination on what they're going to do. So, like, in theory, you could have, in fact, a lot of people say, okay, well, I will just go back to school and we'll see what happens a year from now. The implication of that, though, is, oh, suddenly you have a much weaker draft pool, and the, you know, that throws out of whack, you know, this year's draft order and the teams that were maybe going to have really high picks suddenly get, you know, a shallower group of top talents to work with. And certainly the Astros would be feeling pretty good about losing their first and second round picks in a suddenly less interesting draft. So
yeah, although I did also also argued in my article that is on the site and you should go read that each of those picks means more now because there are fewer of them. So losing those picks has more potential to damage the farm system.
Mm-hmm.
I also think, and this is a little tinfoil hatty that I did not talk about in the article, but this
we're a
feels
podcast
like
for except for tinfoil hats, tinfoil ears.
Like I said, it's an opportunity for Rob Manfred to kind of get what he has wanted all along, which is a smaller draft and compressing the minor league system. But it also is a way to if you mess with the draft like this, it disincentivizes teams from tanking because your draft pick won't matter as much. Like, you just gotta, you're not gonna restock in like a huge draft and then go out and be competitive out of that. So it does disincentivize tanking, which I know is something that has been talked about a lot too.
Yeah. Well, we will see how that pans out. Probably by the time this is published, there will be a formal agreement. Perhaps not, but we will certainly be talking about this in the next few months, particularly as we prepare for whatever the draft may be and the Mariners picks within. But for the moment, let's turn to players already in the system. And we've got five guys today that we're going to chat about, all of whom I think are pretty well-known, pretty prominent relatively, and could very easily either immediately or in the near future be impact players, or at least consistently present players for the Mariners. So let's start just right at number 10. We've got left-handed pitcher Justus Sheffield, as well as number 9, right-handed pitcher Justin Dunn. Sheffield obviously was locked into a rotation spot to start this season, still will be whenever it gets going. Dunn, once Taiwan Walker officially was signed, was pretty sort of locked into a Tacoma rotation spot, assuming health, although, you know, now with a sort of wacky setup with regards to, you know, getting games going, doubleheaders, whatever the schedule actually looks like, we might see guys like Dunn up quite quickly just to fill innings. But in a traditional season, maybe, you know, or looking forward to the future, do we think Justus Sheffield and Justin Dunn are starting pitchers for the Mariners long term?
So I think that Justus Sheffield probably has a little bit better shot than Justin Dunn of sticking in the rotation. That's just my opinion on this. Mm-hmm. They're similar players in what they have going for them and what they need to work on. Most notably, the fastball command has got to improve with both players. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, it's really good fastball breaking ball profiles, obviously, mm-hmm. from different sides, with sort of questionable command.
Yeah, I think with Justus specifically, and this has been reported, the fastball command and the development of that changeup, I think, is going to be obviously very important in what his ceiling is. The slider was good last year, if not inconsistent sometimes, but it's very... it's devastating against right-handers. I don't know why. It just seemed to me like it was an even better pitch against right-handers than it was against left-handers. And the introduction of that two-seamer that he was working on this spring seemed to show a lot of promise. So you can't take anything from spring training other than, you know, positivity and optimism. But he did look like a more refined product out there. And he had some things up his sleeve that he didn't have in 2019. So that is... That's a strong indication for Justus moving forward. I'm not sure whether or not he can hold up over 160 plus innings, but I don't know if that's going to matter in modern baseball. Honestly, I think we're going to go in a different direction. On a different note, I said in the last podcast that I think Justin Dunn ends up as the closer, or I alluded to that, and I still feel that way. I really have questions with whether or not his fastball command is ever going to get to where it needs to be to pitch an entire length of a season. And that being said, he's got a dynamic slider, he's got a dynamic changeup, and he's got a hard fastball. But more importantly, I think Justin Dunn has the athleticism and the build to where you throw him in the bullpen, you say, hey man, we're going to just get you going here. We want 25 of your best pitches. He seems like the type of profile that could throw 97 to 98 with a devastating slider. And if you throw that out on the mound in the eighth or the ninth inning and people have to catch up to it all of a sudden, it certainly reminds me of Edwin Diaz and how that entire thing happened. So, you know, I think he's going to be the closer personally by 2022.
I just don't see that. I don't know. I just think he has a starter's mentality. I mean, this is probably reading too much into that side of things, but just the way that he goes about his business, the way that he talks about his craft, the way that he thinks and approaches, I don't know that I feel comfortable saying I feel like he has a higher ceiling than Sheffield. And more potential to get at what he's got. And I feel when I'm looking at the Yankees development versus the Mets development, I feel more confident that the Yankees have pulled what they could kind of pull out of Sheffield. And that's why they felt like he was a good trade candidate. Whereas I'm not sure that the Mets were maximizing what they had in Justin Dunn. And I'm excited to continue to watch him develop. I think he came a long way in just a year. But yeah, he feels like a starter to me. Obviously the command is going to be the thing that is the issue with him, but I'm not sure too if he has, cause he is kind of a lighter guy. Like, I'm not sure if you tell him to go out there and throw as hard as he can, if he's able to crank it up to 97 or whatever we want closers throwing at these days. So I'm going to put myself in the directly opposite camp to that one. I hope Sheffield figures it out. I have higher hopes for Dunn.
What do you think, this is to John and Kate, what do you think the ceiling for someone like Sheffield is? Because when we acquired him, he was a number two by some publications. Some publications had him as a relief pitcher. But at this point, now with a little more than a year under his belt with the team, what is his glass ceiling?
What I think it depends on what you consider a player like Kenta Maeda to be. Because that's what I see sort of the profile.
Maeda as an upper tier mid-rotation starter. Like, on some teams, I think he would be a number two. But
right.
On a good team, I think he's a 3-4.
Right. So I think that that is where you could hope to see Sheffield. He's got an absolutely dynamic outpitch with the slider that he can sort of vary the sort of profile of a bit. You know, he can have this sort of absolutely knockout swing and miss version, and he can also have a slightly tighter, sharp, you know, smaller movement one that he, I think, can locate for a strike a bit more. And if the sinker that he's been working on, in fact, manifests long term, he has the ability to shorten plate appearances by getting ground balls and getting sort of out of danger at times, even if he has slightly below average command, which I think is a lot to ask him to really fully, you know, work past. But, you know, if he is like a little over a strikeout per inning, walk every three innings or so kind of guy, and he's, you know, just got a good defense behind him, I think that that's someone who throws 150 to 170 innings per year and is pretty dang good during those innings. And you just kind of, you know, you have to work around that. You just have to make sure you have the bullpen or the, you know, the rest of a team that can accentuate for that and say like, okay, well, we have someone who can go, we have a couple people who can go multiple innings, and at least one of them is always relatively ready when Justice is pitching. Cause
yeah,
you know, and, but you know, I mean, that, I think that sort of profile, like Joe said, I think that works in the modern game in a way that it wouldn't have, you know, a decade ago, much less 2-3 decades ago. I think Nate Carnes was the person that we sort of mentioned, and Eric Bedard's another person we've sort of talked about. And like, neither of those are particularly sort of flattering comparisons, but like Nate Karns had a ton going for him, except that he got hurt. Justice Sheffield, for all his sort of flaws, hasn't really had much injury concern. I think he had like some shoulder soreness like 2 years ago, and it hadn't really flared up since. Eric Bedard was a very good pitcher who just didn't throw 200 innings and was like never expected to throw 200 innings. And if you can sort of deal with that, then okay, you know, you plan for that. I think he can be very successful with the right sort of framework around him. Kate, what do you think there?
Yeah, I like the comparison to a Kenta Maeda as far as like his absolute ceiling. I think I would be over the moon thrilled if that was it.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. Certainly, that is a very positive outcome.
I will settle for slightly better than Nate Karns, but also, I mean, I will admit some bias in this, just that Swanson didn't turn out to be anything other than a long reliever, so it would feel sad to have traded away James Paxton for two middle relievers. So really, really just want Justice to stick in that role.
Certainly. And I think that that's the nice thing about this is, more than anything, I think Justice Sheffield needs time to try and be a starting pitcher in the
big leagues. Yeah, can we remind ourselves of how old he is again?
This will be his age 24 season.
Yeah, I mean, he is small compared to some of, I think, how long he has been around in the prospect pipeline, like being tough. If there's an... I'm not sure I can think of somebody with a bigger case of prospect, quote unquote, prospect fatigue around him.
He's pitching Jurickson and Profar. Like,
yes, Jurickson and Profar. Yes, that's a very good example. Hopefully with better results.
So with regards to essentially Dunn's profile, long term, Joe, you obviously see him as someone who could be a very good reliever. Kate, I think you see him as more likely to stick in the rotation than Sheffield. What do you expect that we can see in 2020? I guess, what would you guys want to see from him in 2020? Assuming, I think it's safe to assume he would start with the Rainiers in AAA, or whatever that looks like in this environment.
For me personally, if Justin Dunn is going to stay in the starting rotation, and it goes along the same vein as the walks, I want to see him get ahead of batters early in counts. I know that's redundant. Get ahead of batters, and I want to see him be able to throw his secondary stuff to get ahead. The fastball is, I mean, he throws 95, he can touch 96. It's great, but if you can't land the changeup or you can't land the slider as a first pitch, people are going to catch up to it. The stuff is so good. I mean, you saw how much trouble he got in the big leagues last year. He didn't throw that many innings, but if you watched those innings, you would never have said, yeah, he pitched to a 2.7 ERA. I mean, the stuff is just so good that he can get out of some really nasty jams that he puts himself in. But if he can get ahead of hitters and he can use that secondary stuff to kind of work backwards and redefine his put-away pitch, I mean, he could be one of those pitchers that uses the high fastball after using a couple breaking balls to get ahead to put guys away. So vary the pitch mix a little bit, but more than anything, stay away from hitters' counts, and I think that would raise his ceiling for me.
Okay, well, let's move then to our next pair of players here. We talked obviously about two guys who have made their big league debuts. Now let's go to a couple of people who have barely begun their major league made their professional journeys as players. We've got number 8. Left-handed pitcher Brandon Williamson, and number 7, shortstop Noelvi Marte. So two players, Williamson, 2019 draftee, second round pick, and Marte, a 2018 international free agency signing, who had his first year in the league last year, and was the I believe the Dominican Summer League MVP. He was certainly the Mariners MVP.
No, he was. I'm pretty sure it was the whole DSL.
I believe it was. MVP. Someone was very angry, if I'm not mistaken.
They were angry that Julio was the DSL MVP.
Gotcha. Okay.
It was a Cardinals fan. Mad that their two big guys didn't win it over Julio, and then Julio just went out and destroyed. Noel V. Marte, I must say, is currently my teammate at AAA Tacoma.
Oh,
in
the
Road to the Show. Yes. Those developers did not skimp on the nose. They were like, if we're getting one thing right.
Nor did the original developer on Mr. Noel V. Marte.
That is true. He's got quite a honker, quite the schnoz. They call him Nariz, nose in Spanish. Mm. Seems to be like sort of a loving. He has a large nose. He has the face to carry it off, though. I feel like I'm disparaging. So,
there's a good save.
So let's start with Marte. Kate, you talked with Noel V. Marte when down in Arizona. Obviously, none of us have seen him play really in live games because he's only played in the Dominican and in some brief like scrimmages or whatever in Arizona. Can you just give me like a rundown on what makes Noel V. Marte, 17-year-old kid, maybe 18 now, I'm not entirely sure. What makes him such an exciting prospect, and why he, I think, has been on a couple like top 100 lists nationally already, despite not playing a game stateside?
Yeah, it's the power. I mean, in prospecting, power talks, and it is the power combined with a pretty good eye at the plate. He really doesn't strike out that much. He takes his walks. Mm-hmm. He's a disciplined hitter, but he does have that power, and it's power to all fields. So, the bat is going to carry him wherever he winds up defensively. Mm-hmm. The prospect evaluators who are a little low on Marte, and I think Fangraphs is, they just really hate our style of, no wonder Longenhagen got very tinfoil hatty saying the Mariners are messing with other teams' scouting by promoting players, for spot starts at AAA or whatever. Like, that's not why they do that. But yeah, I think that's a very frustrating team to have to write about if they're not just the one team you have to follow all the time, which is us, because there have been some questions about, well, Marte was so, he overmatched, that level was too easy for him. Like, they should have sent him up. And the Mariners will just not do that.
It's the same thing that happened with Julio Rodriguez.
The only guys that they will promote are guys who are maybe a little older at their signing.
Diason Arias didn't play in the Dominican League, if I recall correctly. Or if he did, he very briefly. But he was like 20
or 21.
He
was definitely there in training. I can look this up. But I know he spent time there, so maybe it was just training. Anyway, a huge part of what they want to do with the Dominican Academy is give these guys like a foundation and inculcate to them some of the organizational values. So that's why. Was the DSL too easy for Noel V. Marte? Probably. Like, he easily could have been challenged at another level. But the Mariners are willing to slow play a prospect in their first year and not rush them and kind of move them quickly once they're stateside, but really give them that time to adjust, to teach them about what being a professional ball player means, to teach them what being a Seattle Mariner means. Mm-hmm. And they really build this like sense of community and camaraderie there. Mm-hmm. And still provide plenty of links. So like Noel V was at the high performance camp and he roomed with Julio Rodriguez and he's very much like kind of modeled himself on that path. And then you have the ball players who are like a year down who are looking at Noel V and they're modeling, you know. And then you have guys who aren't even in the system yet, like Starling Aguilar, who hasn't even been signed. The Mariners are the favorites to sign him, but he's looking at all those guys. So it's just like making this chain down the line. I think that if you hit well in the DSL, you can hit well in the AZL. Like, I don't know how much. Yes, the pitching is more challenging stateside, but I think anyone who saw Marte hit, like, that's just, it's not just that he is overmatched.
That's not where he's going to be challenged, right? Like, yeah. It's got to be higher levels where he's going to be challenged. Especially because he has the speed to leg out, you know, weaker.
Yeah, and I think that that's the other, yes, I am not wrong. Dae-sun did play in the DSL.
Yes, you're correct. You're correct.
Yes, that's my favorite phrase. Kate was right. I think that what scouts really seem to like about Marte is not just the power, but the power speed combo. So for a big guy, he runs really well, is really smart on the bases. What surprised me about Noel V. Marte when I met him was he was not at all what I was expecting, because his social media presence is very restrained in a lot of ways. He doesn't, like, he was like, he won't do like the viral challenges that are going around and stuff. He's pretty, he keeps it pretty buttoned up. So I expected him to be like kind of shy, a little quiet. His English is also definitely not where Julio's was at this point last year, not to create an unfair comparison between the two of them, but just Noel V didn't have the advantage of having taken classes as a young kid. So he's a little bit, I would say more where the average player is, if not a little above, but you know, you can't be expecting a Julio like, you know, long discursive discussions in English. He's extremely thoughtful. He's a very mature, composed person. He takes a lot of personal responsibility. He's very intentional in everything that he does. And he's very deep. Like, he has some really interesting things to say, which I will type up. I have been sitting on this interview since the Fall League, and it's terrible. It's the kind of content we need right now, though. He surprised me with his depth and his maturity and how kind of the still waters run deep, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I'm super excited to watch him whenever we get to see him again.
So the concern with Marte is, you know, and it's the concern, you know, the concern with this 17, 18 year old kid who, you know, is probably not done growing, much less done developing, has been, okay, he has great speed, he's got fabulous, you know, sort of power and you know, reasonable instinct, good bat speed. Is he able to stick at shortstop? Because there were a fair number of mistakes. Yeah. In the Dominican, and that is really, I think we generally are very wary of any sort of numbers that come out of the Dominican, not because they're wrong, but just because when you have someone like Marte, who, as you said, is so much more physically developed than, you know, the people he's playing against, then and like the average fastball in the Dominican is at 88 miles per hour, I think, according to Baseball America. Like, there's not necessarily, you know, that's not necessarily getting the sort of full sense of where a guy's aiming to develop. But sort of scouts that we have read and people that we've heard from said his glove work was not great and his footwork was not great at the start of the year, and supposedly that improved, but you know, is there, do you guys have a sense, Joe, do you think that Marte seems like he's on track to stick in the infield, because obviously that would make his trajectory to the big leagues much smoother and put less pressure on the bat and his just general offensive profile.
Yeah, I think reports that I read, and I don't remember the coach that was down. I talked to a coach that was down there towards the latter half of the year last year. Yeah, they said that things had begun to clean up there over the last few weeks of the season. So that's really good to hear. If he sticks at shortstop, I think that all will be dependent on how he grows. I don't know if that's necessarily going to be based on whether he can handle the position, because right now at the size that he's at, I know he's only 18, but he has the lateral mobility to get to most balls that, from what I've read, and he's got a huge arm. So he'll be able to stick at the position if he doesn't outgrow it. The thing with me that I think you can really discount not being able to play great defense right now as a 17 or 18 year old. One comparison that I found kind of interesting, I was talking to someone on Twitter about, is Trevor Story. And you can never want to put Trevor Story as a label on what he's going to be, because that's not fair at all. But when Trevor Story was drafted out of high school as an 18-year-old and played his first year at 18, he was fielding ground balls at like a 9-15 rate. Like, that's really bad. And Noel V. Marte was at 8.95 last year, which is, I mean, it's not good. But if Trevor Story can get to the point where he's a big leaguer and he's now in the 980s range, and every year he got a little bit better, I don't think it's hard to, you know, see with hard work Noel V. Marte getting there as well. Mm-hmm. And frankly, you saw Marco Luciano with the Giants last year go from like 95 to 115 in the rankings in the preseason to, he's in some people's top 10 now, because mm-hmm. he gets monster exit velos, he runs well, and he plays a reasonable shortstop. Mm-hmm. Noel V. Marte is built to have that exact same trajectory, where he shows up in West Virginia and he just tears the cover off the ball, or he does Arizona and tears the cover off the ball, finishes the year at, you know, A ball, and his ascent could be massive this year. So I take a little bit away from the defense for now and just see how he handles things in 2020 at the position. And if he has to move because he's, you know, 215 pounds by the end of the year, then he has to move.
I will say, and I think, like you said, like the bat can cover up a lot of shortfall defensively. If you are a super above average bat, like, we can kind of hold your nose about the defense a little, right? He has trimmed down noticeably from when he was drafted. He says he's eating, the Mariners taught him how to eat, without so much fat. He's eating a lot of leaner meats now, because he does have the kind of a body that can carry a lot of weight. It can bulk up. He's a big kid. But he has really, and I think that was part of the reason he was out at high performance camp, is he's just gotten pretty shredded over the past year or so. He's pretty narrow hipped now, but like broad shouldered, just strong, lean and strong, much more so than in pictures that I looked at his earlier signing days, where he was mm-hmm. carrying a fair amount of baby fat around. So he's definitely a lean, mean machine. I watched him take some infield practice at spring training, the lone practice day that I got, in which I saw both these players, actually, Brandon Williamson and Noel V. He was working at second, so that is a big caveat, but I thought he looked, and it was rough. It was rough out there. He just didn't, and again, he was working at second, not at short, but he was making mistakes, and he was vocal about it, and taking instruction from Lewis Boyd, who is a very gifted defensive coach, a very gifted infielder, which also must have been frustrating, because Boyd would be there and he'd make like the perfect play, and Noel V would just kind of look at him like, what? Yeah, oh yeah, just do that? Okay. Which I talked to him a little bit after, and he was like blown away by how good Boyd was out there.
Well, that's the kind of thing you want to see, right? Really, like, you know,
absolutely.
It's sort of, you know, whether it's a coach or another player, right? Like, you want,
you want
those young, really talented players to see, like, I still have a long ways to go.
Yeah. And to see what the standard looks like. Like, this is what the standard of a professional, you know, guy who didn't make it that high in the system, but, you know,
but, if his bat was, you know, that well.
He literally cannot hit at all.
Yeah.
If he had been able to hit even a little, you know, would probably still be playing right now.
Yeah.
What I noticed about Marte is, like, his length is a lot in his legs. He's just tall, like. But he's got super long legs and he's got a long torso. And I know he hinges forward at the waist and he doesn't really get down in his legs as much as you'd like him to.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is just, it's just going to be, and from what I could observe, you know, from across the field, that looked to be like what Boyd was teaching him. Boyd was kind of teaching him how to be more efficient with his pass to the ball. Like, Novi would throw one way and Boyd would correct him and be like, no, we want to, you can save time and be more accurate if you just flip it like this. And so I think a little bit of it is just having better coaches is going to improve him and just kind of increasing that comfort. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not better necessarily, but maybe working with guys who are a little higher in the food chain. In the organization and getting in that focus. I mean, you can only work on so many things at once, right? Like,
right.
So yeah, if that's what he focuses on in the AZL with some of the great coaches that we have there, then I feel pretty good about that.
Yeah. Well, let's shift then to the other person who you saw and who is in this group here, our eighth overall prospect. Lefty pitcher Brandon Williamson. So Williamson is unless you made it to Everett at the right time last year, you probably have not seen much of Brandon Williamson. I don't, Joe, did you get a chance to actually see Williamson at Everett?
Yeah.
Last year? Okay, you did. Okay.
Yeah, well, I got two innings in.
From both you, Joe, and then Kate, I want to hear about your sort of what you saw in his bullpen. What has changed to make Brandon Williamson not just essentially what he was on draft day, which was like kind of an, you know, injury worry, tall but low 90s lefty who it wasn't totally clear you know what they had in him when they took him in the second round into. People are now talking about him as a fringe top 100 guy and someone who, if development breaks the right way and if he's able to be healthy, knock on wood, you know, looks like they could be a starting pitcher for the Mariners long term.
Well, the durability concern is something that will obviously need to be watched, but they weren't arm injuries, so that's something that you can...
Both his hip labrums?
Yeah, how do you do that?
I believe dunking a basketball, I believe, is what.
Oh, yeah, that's how I tore my labrums, too.
Yeah, you know, just a cool, just 6'6 guy things.
yeah.
Like, yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I do the same thing, reaching for pots and pans above my fridge. 5'9 things. Anyways, with Brandon, I think the thing that sticks out is the entire track record of him at TCU was 90 to 92, touching 93. Good slider, good breaking ball, had a hard time commanding both, but they showed good shape, and a changeup that he mixed in here and there. In Everett, he was pumping, and here's the thing that makes it tricky. He'd go out and pitch anywhere between 1 and 3 innings, but in those short stints, he was like 94 to 96. He touched 97. He was landing the curveball and the breaking ball for strikes consistently with ease. He wasn't walking batters. And the changeup was still just an average changeup, but that is a full arsenal. So, you know, there's people in the organization that think Williamson, at the time, this is like early August, mid-August, he was the best starting pitching prospect in the organization. And that's with Logan Gilbert involved. Now, at this point, I don't think anybody would say that, because the way Gilbert looked this spring, it's hard to make that argument. Gilbert looks like a true possible ace. But for someone to come out and say that he's in the same conversation as Gilbert, and even more so, you know, ahead of Kirby, really says a lot. The thing that's going to be interesting with Brandon Williamson is going to be, can he continue to throw the breaking balls for strikes, and can he bury them when he needs to? Because if they're better than above average offerings, if they're 55 grade offerings, and he can couple that with a surprise fastball that is, you know, even 92 to 95 from the left side, that's a really, really exciting profile. And the comparison that I got from Brian DeLunas was, he does feel like what James Paxton was before James Paxton took that next step and found more velo and found the knuckle curve and things like that. So, you know, if Brandon Williamson ends up being James Paxton light, that's obviously a huge win.
Skinny.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he is. They're both really, really tall, lanky lefties that come out from that huge three-quarter arm slot. So I could see it, and I think I was the high man on Brandon Williamson in the entire staff. So
yeah, definitely.
I see more Chris Sale in Brandon Williamson's frame than I do James Paxton, but I would be excited to see if he can bulk up like Pax and maybe add some of that consistent ability to hold the velo, because obviously that's what you're talking about, right? It's just short stints that we've seen him in.
Right.
But I mean, if the floor is potential closer / late inning reliever with him, I mean, you're not hurting yourself so much in that draft, because we also have George Kirby, we also have Isaiah Campbell. Like, we don't need all of those guys to hit as much.
Yeah, they stocked up pretty. They leaned real heavily on pitching in that group, and
having a draft historically known as being weak on pitching, which was an interesting zag when everyone else was zigging.
Yeah, I mean, that is really where the Mariners are going to make or break, right? You know, it is, they bought in very heavily on, we can develop these specific traits, you know, off of these specific traits in pitchers. And they've seen success in that, particularly with bullpen guys. And most of that has been, they didn't have better than bullpen talents in their system necessarily by the time they had this player dev group fully established. So this is where it has to be, right? It has to be the Brandon Williamsons. It has to be the George Kirby's, the Logan Gilberts, the, you know, the Michael Limoncelli's, you know, the Sam Carlson's, and, you know, the guys who, the, you know, Justice Sheffield's and Justin Dunn's even, you know, those are the guys who they have to make their hay with, because, you know, okay, you've got your people in place, you know, you've got universally regarded solid talents. Now you have to make what they should be or more out of that, because that's where they've invested sort of really heavily. With regards to Williamson, just before we move to our last player, I thought it was very interesting hearing you guys sort of do the Paxton Sale sort of comparison there. Obviously the curveball is sort of the most exciting breaking pitch there for Williamson. Just for purely, not necessarily an aesthetic, but like personal preference, like style of left-handed pitcher, because there have been several notable lefties who are huge tall guys with this great stuff. Would you in a vacuum rather see a guy like Williamson coming from like a real tall angle like Paxton does, or from that like almost sidearm angle like Sale or Randy Johnson? Like what do you just purely aesthetically prefer to watch in a lefty?
Well, watching a Chris Sale slider is, you just feel bad for the batters.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's just a creature of its own. But I've always really liked the high arcing, you know, Barry Zito left-handed curveball type of thing, like mm-hmm. that Reed, like the Reed Detmers curveball. Mm-hmm. That it's just mm-hmm. it's beautiful. It's a
beautiful curveball.
It's beautiful mm-hmm. to watch. It, even
it's,
if it,
it's gonna, I mean, that's gonna make Clayton Kershaw a Hall of Famer, right?
Yeah, like Clayton Kershaw, another tall, great example.
Over the top curve, yeah.
So I think just the prototypical 12-6 from the left side would be my vote. Mm-hmm. Even if it gets crushed, it's really pretty to watch. That's why I watch
good
the Dodgers.
Coming in.
That's why,
looks good.
That's why I watch the Dodgers every October.
Oh, God. Oh, man. Joe, on it's opening rough. Day.
I mean, I agree with Joe's overall sentiment. Maybe not that last part, but I agree. I love the aesthetics of just a hammer. I love a hammer curve. When Paxton was just breaking off those hammer curves in his, what was it, 14K game, 12K, whatever it was.
Yeah, the massive, yeah.
Randy right. Johnson, they were replaying his 20K game, mm-hmm. Is, I wouldn't call it aesthetically pleasing to watch. It is terrifying.
He's a brutalist pitcher.
Brutal.
I think
is... Yeah, brutalist. If we're doing architectural styles, yes, Randy Johnson is something the German expressionists dreamed up. Yeah, it's frightening. Like I do like, I think the slightly more gentlemanly elegance of the hammer curve where it just falls through the trapdoor at the end.
Did you guys see the, I hadn't seen it. The Randy Johnson slider that,
The recent Pitching Ninja
that Rob Friedman posted the other yeah. day that it almost went between the guy's legs and he panic swung at it. And he jumped over it?
Yep. I hadn't seen it before.
Neither had I.
Posted. It was unbelievable. I mean, just comical. What? Yeah, no. What an outrageous, like, thing to have just been commonplace for, like, 2 decades. Just, yeah. Oh, you have, like, a literal, like, historical giant on the mound, throwing the ball harder than anyone else, and he might know where it's going, and then he'll also, you know, it looks
also
like he's
an
releasing.
Element of the terror.
Yeah, and the slider. I mean, you know, I remember Randy Johnson as a Mariner. I remember I was at a game at the Kingdom where he pitched, but like I was very young, so like much of my Randy Johnson memory is of him with the Diamondbacks and with the Yankees and like later, like not quite the, you know, zenith of Randy Johnson as a true force of nature, good and bad. So yeah.
When I was really young in my playing days, I remember the first time, I think it was like 8th grade. We ran into a pitcher on my team that threw 90 mm-hmm. and this is one of the more embarrassing moments of my upbringing, but I was the second baseman, and I specifically asked the coach, I was like, Coach, I don't want to play today. I am not interested in being in the lineup.
You had good sort of self-preservation.
Self-preservation. And the same thing happened in 7th grade when I was like 105 pounds, and the coach called a receiver reverse, mm-hmm. and I was a receiver. I asked to be taken out of the game because I had no interest in taking that, you know, out of the backfield. And I can only imagine that's how John Kruk and all these guys felt.
Yeah.
Having to step in the box against that guy. Like, and they're grown
absolutely
men.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely.
It's sad to me that Chris Sale has just fallen off so quickly. Yeah. Because the experience of being like, oh God, not Chris Sale, and just watching yeah. him mow through. I mean, it was absolute dread because he was pitching always mm-hmm. when I watched him. Mostly, I guess, when I watched him pitching against us and mowing through various hapless Mariner lineups. So,
yeah. I mean, it really is. It's the closest thing to Randy Johnson that
yeah.
I think people, you know,
just unhittable. Yeah. Absolutely. When he was on, just absolutely unhittable. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. boy, I'd sure like to have that sometime. I feel like we've done so much as Mariner yeah. fans with like so mm-hmm. little as far as pitching. Like, mm-hmm. we are willing to crown soft-tossing Marco Gonzalez an ace. Like, we're that desperate. So mm-hmm. it would just be so nice to have somebody who you could roll out and was just filth every fifth day or something. And I know we had Felix for a long time that could be that.
That's kind of my only reservation with Seattle taking Reed Detmers is you're drafting a really polished guy, but you're not going to see anything more than 92 unless Gaskamp turns something on for him. I mean, you're going to get that just gorgeous curveball, mm-hmm. but you're not going to be drafting a pitcher at number six that ever is going to blow anyone away. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a big, like, was it last year? Ryan Rolison, or it was 2 years ago, Ryan Rolison, who was like heavily mocked and like targeted by the Mariners. And it's like, it's that same profile where it's like, this person's mm-hmm. probably going to be a major leaguer
mm-hmm.
and probably not super exciting. I mean, that was Marco Gonzalez. Like,
yeah, I mean, there was Ryan Weathers was last year. Ryan yeah. Rolison was 2 years ago. And
yes.
unfortunately for Rolison, another one is David Peterson.
I remember.
Yeah, absolutely. David Peterson. Mm-hmm. And Rolison finally got to that high A level last year and ran into a brick wall. So
yeah.
I don't know. The pitches have to be good. You got to have kind of that Marco ingredient of a good cutter mm-hmm. to mix with the good curveball mm-hmm. and high fast. Yeah, got to be careful.
Give me Jared Kelly, please. If we're going to look for who I think the arm in this 2020 draft is with the most chance of, like, blossoming into that, who's being talked about in the top rounds, like, and a prep player that I would feel comfortable with, like,
mm-hmm.
are you willing
making that
to,
investment in, I like him.
Are you willing to live with potentially a decade of Jared Kelly, Jared Kelnick?
Like JK's
yeah,
the killer,
like the
JK's, killer JK,
the jokester, like the jokes.
JK squared.
Yeah. Oh God.
Man, I mean, I wasn't even prepared to live through the Jose Siri.
Yeah, well, and you didn't have to.
didn't have to do it for long.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of outfielders with all kinds of tools, sort of winding paths to the top levels of the league. Our final player on the list today, number six, outfielder Kyle Lewis. Kyle, one of the, probably the best part about last year, I don't know, you guys may feel differently, or there may have been individual moments, but like, there was nothing cooler about the 2019 season, which didn't have a lot cool about it, than like, Isabel and I stayed up late to watch Kyle Lewis's debut. We were really excited. Like, the Mariners hadn't had sort of a top pick in a while sort of make it and stick. And to have him, yes, you know, it was weird and not super sustainable, but like, from a pure excitement standpoint, like, it was so gratifying, I guess. Like, did you guys sort of have this sense of like, this is what a rebuild is all about, you know, to a sense of you know, with Kyle Lewis getting to the bigs last year?
No, I mean, no. Sorry.
Jeez.
A Mariner fan can have a little top prospect succeeding in limited amounts as a treat.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, here's this, it felt like the universe saying, here's this balm for witnessing this incredibly painful year of baseball. We're really sorry about the 13-0. Did not mean to let that happen. Someone was asleep on the controls. Should not have happened. Management apologizes. Please enjoy this appetizer plate of Kyle Lewis dingers as a, you know, thank you for your continued patronage. That was how that felt. Like, I don't expect that to continue at the same level. That being said, I'm still excited to see a player who is has been drafted, developed entirely by this front office, make it
literally
up to the major
first
league
player
level.
Drafted by this front office.
Yeah. I will not really be excited though until Logan Gilbert gets up. Like that is because unfortunately it's not his fault, but Kyle Lewis just had, I mean, he ran into that buzzsaw of the injury, and it's been a pretty difficult developmental path. So it for me, it's really going to take until there's Gilbert up and Evan White and, yes, Kyle Lewis and, like, a few other just pure homegrown players before I'm like, that's a spicy rebuild.
I thought the I thought Kyle Lewis coming up and hitting all those bombs in, like, 10 games was one of the cooler moments in a few years.
Yeah, Kate.
Yeah, I mean, hell.
This is so odd. I'm usually, like, blowing sunshine up everyone's asses.
It's totally okay to, like, not think Kyle Lewis is going to be the second coming, but, I mean, you got to take the good moments as a Mariners fan when you get them.
I think that it was a lot of, and especially last year when we were trying to enjoy the hot start, and everyone was like, this is unsustainable. The Mariners will break your heart. I was so tired of that and reacted so, like, strongly to that, that when it happened again, I was just like, I can't get too invested in this.
Kind of a microcosm of that is Kyle Lewis coming up, and for some reason, like, half of the industry just decided to go, yeah, but the power's not real. The exit velocities aren't real.
So weird. He's,
and I'm just like, has nobody watched him play? I mean, there are obvious, there's faults in his swing, and there are issues with his plate discipline. And
yeah, Joe, you had actually a really good piece sort of breaking down.
The
development of his swing.
Right, there are warts.
I believe a piece that was referenced on MLB Network in one of our cooler moments as a site.
Yeah. But the thing is, like, warts and everything totally aside, he's 6'4", he's 220 pounds, he's going to hit the hell out of the ball, and his exit velos are very, very real. He had the highest barrel percentage of anybody in baseball from the time he got called up until the end of the year. And number two was Nelson Cruz. And number three was Joey Gallo. So he hit the ball very, very hard. Yeah. Now, as far as what his future with the team looks like, he's got the arm to play the outfield. I don't know if the defense, it's probably a little bit below average. It's probably not quite what we were expecting when he got drafted as a center fielder, but the bat is going to have to be,
he's not
going to
embarrass
him.
Himself in
no
the corner
definitely out, not I the FanGraphs thing that was posted the other day, let me see if I can just pull it up and kind of reference it. They said, on balance, Lewis is probably a 45 player, a 1.5 war player during his prime years of control. He's got plus-plus impact power and could get hot and make some all-star teams along the way. That, I could not say it any better. I think that's spot on. I think at his peak, he's probably going to be 1.5 to 2 war. He's probably going to be a 240 hitter, 238 hitter, and he hits 30 to 35 bombs. And when Julio and Kelenic come up, whether or not Haniger's still with the team, whether or not Seattle spends on another outfielder altogether, he's probably going to be a designated hitter unless he finds more contact. But even then, it's such a cool story. I mean, the guy has been through so much. He's got an awesome personality. He's a very wholesome kid. And I'm really looking forward to watching him hit. I'm praying, not for the future of the Mariners, not for the future of, you know, the outfield or anything. I'm praying that he hits enough to stay with the team this year, because he's just really he's just really fun to watch.
I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, when going into this winter, I was thinking, well, it was really great, you know, and I loved it, and it made me very happy. He should probably start in Tacoma in all the same to start 2020. And the team was talking about, well, he's going to be the starting left fielder. He's going to be the starting left fielder. And then Mitch Haniger got hurt, and the issue sort of it seemed resolved itself. I guess, do you guys think he should be just starting in the minors to start this season? Or do you think, like, those warts that he has, but also that, you know, that impressive top-level talent when he does make contact with the ball, do you think that that just needs to be worked out at the big league level at this point?
I'm personally impartial about whether he starts at AAA or the big leagues, because personally, I think Kyle Lewis is a little bit closer to a finished product than a lot of people give him credit for. The issues that he has right now have always been issues, and he now has more than a couple years under his belt where he's been playing consistent baseball. He's seen, you know, a year and a half of AA pitching. AAA is just going to bloat his numbers a little bit to where I think you're not going to get an accurate representation
bloat,
of what he's going to be.
Bloat! I say bloat away! I want to see the bloating! Fatten it up! I mean, he toiled all that time in AA in that awful park. Like, I think Kyle Lewis deserves a tour of the PCL. It doesn't have to be for long. Come on, don't you agree? Like, don't you think he, of all people, deserves to get to just go smash a gazillion-ty foot homer in El Paso?
I tell you what, if you take Kyle Lewis out of the current Mariners lineup and you stick Braden Bishop in it, I dare you to find a cleanup hitter, because that is... that is one boring lineup without Kyle Lewis in it. So, I don't know.
Excuse me, one cool. Large adult son would like a word.
Yeah, he hit like 190, though.
No, I agree with you, though. Like, I will say that I was tuning into those games towards the end of last season with an interest in watching Kyle Lewis play, because he was young and exciting. And what I'm missing out on right now, what I feel like I'm missing out on, is getting to see Evan White have his opening day moment. Like, getting to see Kyle Lewis, like, getting to, and knowing that those guys are like best friends, and, you know, Kyle was in Evan's wedding. I'm really feeling like we're missing out on that. But first, he can go hit a couple big bombs in AAA. The big league team is going to suck with or without him.
Yeah, I like the I'm glad you mentioned Nelson Cruz, Joe, because I don't think that that's really like that is an immense amount to ask for anyone, because Cruz has been just so sort of consistent for so long.
Oh yeah. Well, you and I talked and I don't mean to cut your thought off, but and I talked about him being like Jorge Soler is what I think would be the optimal outcome, you know?
Yeah.
And it took Soler like 3 or 4 big league seasons to finally hit 270. He was 230 to 240 most of his career.
Yeah. No, I mean, it took three organizations? Two or three organizations. I mean, it was like... it took Nelson Cruz a really long time. Like, Nelson Cruz was a Mets prospect for a while and, like, debuted quite late. Like... Nelson Cruz has been pretty extraordinary ever since he's been in the big leagues, but like it took him a really long time to be consistent, because I think guys that big and that, you know, athletic don't always have the easiest time adjusting to the top quality competition. But that doesn't mean that they are finished products in the same way. I think you mentioned like he's close to being a finished product in the sense that like, he can handle velocity. He can handle, you know, he has the right mentality, but like, it's really just a reps issue in my mind. And I would not hate it if he went to AAA, but like on this Mariners team, especially if Haniger's still, you know, not back whenever the season starts, like put him out there. It doesn't really like you let him succeed. You let him fail. You let him keep working through it. And you have him have the mentality of like, you're going to be a big league player, and this is part of working through it. Because I think there is that sort of everyday, you know, capable everyday player there. Even if the sort of pathway to it is a little Soler-y or, you know, Zunino-y even. Because I think the offensive talent there is one of the more impressive in the entire system.
One other thing I want to add really quick, and this might change because the big league season is being pushed back, but another reason I wouldn't mind if he started at the big league level is because Seattle opened this year. They were supposed to open with Texas today, and then Minnesota, Kansas City, Chicago. I mean, those teams aren't exactly like chock full of aces. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of a softer landing. It's not like 2019, and I know we lit him up, but it's not like you start the season against Chris Sale and then Nathan Eovaldi, and then you know, you kind of go through that buzzsaw early on where hitting was going to be a bigger ask. Mm-hmm. I just think if you're going to start with like Kansas City and the White Sox and things like that, it might be the best opportunity you've got to start him off on a little bit of a hotter streak.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you guys for going through another five players here. Obviously next week, sadly, we will not be about to start the minor league season.
Oh,
just pretty heartbreaking. But we will be talking through the top five prospects in the system. We'll probably have a little more clarity on what the draft is going to look like, and anything else that really comes out on that front, we'll be covering for you guys. We have a whole bunch of draft content on the site, and we'll probably start digging into that once the top prospect list concludes next week, as we sort of work through this time without much real baseball happening in the U.S. So thank you all for bearing with us. I know it's weird to try and get hyped about distant players in any circumstance, much less when there's not baseball happening and when spring training is not happening. It sucks. It sucks in a big way for all of us. This is something we love doing. That's why we do it. But, you know, we appreciate you all listening and getting involved and giving us feedback, because that makes it a lot more fun for us as well. So we'll talk to you again soon next week. Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Joe. Anything else you guys want to finish on for these before we head out?
I just want to reiterate that it's okay to not participate in the rewatches of games and the faux season. It depresses me personally. And I feel like there's a big push, especially on like baseball Twitter, and obviously teams are pushing it because they need content. And we probably should be, but I honestly just can't find, I'm sad. And I feel like losing the MLB season for however long we've lost it is a loss, and it's something that you need to grieve. And I don't know. I don't want to get to LL Live Journal on this, but yeah, it's something I'm trying to think about and process the grief and make decisions for myself about what I feel like I am capable of doing. And right. Yeah, just not watching the games. I know, John, you're very into rewatching the games and getting all this. It's a spectrum. Doing one or the other doesn't make you any better or worse of a fan. And just remember that you are grieving the loss of something right now. So be nice to yourself.
I'll add one thing. If you haven't seen it, minor leaguers are obviously going through a much tougher time than a lot of us are, because they're out of work. They're barely getting by with any paychecks. So I would encourage anyone that is listening and has the wherewithal to do so, go and visit Emily Walden's Twitter page. It's at Emily C. Walden. She's been handling a big minor league employment project that is helping minor leaguers be gainfully employed during this time. She's working with nonprofits to help support them financially in any ways possible. So give back in any way that you can, and she's an excellent follow just to, you know, stay in the know about minor league baseball and to support these guys that are having it tougher than a lot of us.
Oh, and related to that, Adopt a Minor Leaguer is also doing some drives to help out individual players that reach out to him. And one is a Mariners player and is somebody who we've discussed, we've written about, who is engaged to be married, and he's out of work, obviously. His fiance, who works in the fitness industry, also out of work. And then they are located in Nashville, and their house was recently damaged by the tornadoes there, which ate up all their wedding budget. So that's another one. You can find them at Adopt MILB Player on Twitter, and just let them know that you can DM the guy and let them know that you're donating to the Mariners Player Fund and kind of help these guys get back on their feet a little bit.
Absolutely. Well, thank you both. Thank you for being so proactive. Thanks for taking time to talk about some players and some potential for the future. I think it's really important to have things to look forward to right now, and I think that can be challenging. So
for sure, now more than ever.
Now more than ever, indeed. So until next time, hope you all stay safe, stay well, and go Mariners. Kate?